read by me. Whoops. But by William Schultz, who used to be the Unitarian president. Come into this place of peace and let its silence heal your spirit. Come into this place of memory and let its history warm your soul. Come into this place of prophecy and power and let its vision change your heart.
Our first song today is in the Prairie Songbook, and it's number 48, Ain't Gonna Study War No More, and Eileen Nettleton will be accompanying. One verse. Now, Rebecca Malke-Eleganti, our Youth Religious Education Coordinator, will be reading a story for all ages. Almost all ages. Would you like me to hold the microphone? Who wants to see the pictures can come up front.
This story is called The Coconut Monk. There once was a monk who lived on a small island in Vietnam. He spent his time sitting in a coconut tree and eating coconuts, so people called him the Coconut Monk. The Coconut Monk had two good friends, a cat and a mouse. Every day, they would climb the coconut tree and play together. The coconut monk enjoyed sitting high in the tree with his friends. He would watch the boats going by on the Mekong Delta and listen to the birds sing. The coconut monk lived in a time when Vietnam was at war. All the fighting made him very sad. One day, he went out walking. While he walked, he collected bits of metal, pieces of bombs and bullets that littered the land. He melted all the pieces together and turned them into a beautiful bell. He told the pieces of metal, "You have been playing the game of war. Now you can help create peace." Every night before going to sleep, he would strike the bell. Its music echoed out into the night sky. The coconut monk decided to go and ask the president to stop the war. He didn't have any belongings, so packing was very easy. He just climbed down the tree and he was ready to go. But the coconut monk didn't go alone. His two friends, the cat and the mouse, came along to keep him company. They traveled for many days and nights. Even though the road was rough and the journey long, they stopped often and noticed the beauty around them. At night, the monk slept leaning against a tree, and the cat and the mouse slept together in a basket. Sometimes it was rainy and cold, and the friends huddled together. Other times it was warm, and they played in the sunshine. Finally, they reached the presidential palace, a huge white building surrounded by guards. The guards would not let them in. "What can you, a simple monk, have to say to the president?" they demanded. The coconut monk held up the basket with the cat and the mouse playing happily together. I would like all people to live together in peace, he said, the way my friends, the cat and the mouse, do. Surely our differences are not bigger than theirs. When the guards heard this, they became angry. You fool, they shouted, and grabbed the monk. They threw him in the prison. Because the cat and the mouse wouldn't leave their friend, the guards had to throw them in prison too. The prison was dark and cold, but the coconut monk sat very quietly and continued to breathe peacefully, just as he had in his coconut tree. The coconut monk shared his food with the cat and the mouse and all the other prisoners, and even though there wasn't much food, the cat didn't eat the mouse. People started asking about the coconut monk. They wrote letters and visited him in prison. Soon the guards had no choice but to release him. The monk, the cat, and the mouse returned to their coconut tree. If a cat and a mouse can live together in peace, don't you think we humans can too? Yeah, the end.
Oh, thank you. Alice Sliding reading will be read by Rose Smith, and you can follow along in your order of service.
This is from Micah 4:3 in the Bible. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. But they shall sit under their own vines and fig trees, and no one shall make them afraid.
We will now have a minute of silent reflection. As a caring community, we now take the time to briefly share any special joys, sorrows, or concerns with our community. And please wait for the microphone. Mary.
Well, I had the joy of meeting with my mother and my sister, Marty, and her husband, and their son, Kevin, and his wife, and their two little girls who are, six and four. This weekend we went to the geology museum and these little girls had a great time there looking at all the minerals and the bones and everything. And then we went to the zoo. And I have a concern about my mother. My mother, you may know that my mother had a baby, you know, like 50 years ago who was exchanged in the hospital. And so we raised the wrong child in our family. And she was being interviewed, and the other mother and the two daughters were being interviewed this weekend. And I got a call from my mother's caretaker today saying that the interviewers kept saying to her, you should have seen to it that that baby was exchanged. And, of course, there was no way. She did the best she could at that time. And so I'm waiting to have a chance to talk to my mother, and I hope we can repair whatever damage was done. But I think this will be, this was planned to be an interview or a story on NPR eventually. So I'm hoping that my mother hasn't been guilt-tripped too much about that.
Anyone else? Okay, then Rose, would you like to introduce our speaker today?
Here we go. This microphone. You take this one. Better. It is my great pleasure to introduce Joanne and Joe Elder with their friend Mike Baim from the Medicine Quaker Society. They've been peace activists for many years, but today they're going to talk about the 40th anniversary of the My Lai massacre. In the early 1990s, Vietnam veteran Mike Baim and the Madison Quakers teamed up to raise $1,000 for microloans for women in Vietnam. Since then, the microloan project has expanded to include a peace park and a set of school buildings in the village of My Lai, site of a U.S. military massacre of over 500 civilians in March 16, 1968, during the Vietnam War. On March 16, 2008, the 40th anniversary of the My Lai massacre, Joanne and Joe Elder, members of the Madison Quakers, attended the official memorial ceremony at the site of the My Lai massacre. They also helped plant trees at the nearby Quaker Peace Park, visited homes of village women who had received microloans, and participated in the groundbreaking ceremony for the third school building paid for by funds raised by Mike Baim and the Madison Quakers. And at the end of the program today, Mike has cards that were created by My Lai children to sell to for continuing this project. They'll be for sale in the lobby after the service. So I hope you'll help with that. And please welcome our dear friends, Joanne and Joe Elder.
We're going to pass it back. Joe and I are going to take turns talking, and Mike Baim is here too, so we'll just pass the mic, I think. The first pictures are simply sort of where is My Lai in terms of Vietnam. As you look at the map, this is, well, I'll go back to the, there, thank you. This is a map of the Quang Ngai district, which is where the village of My Lai was. Ironically, the American Friends Service Committee did have a hospital in Quang Ngai, and I actually was able to visit the hospital during the war. At that time, we didn't know the massacre had occurred, but it occurred just a few miles where the hospital was. Technology has its pluses and its minuses there, yeah. Okay, the plan that the military carried out was, in a sense, to move in and probably just destroy the village that was called My Lai, because the notion was that this was a center for the Viet Cong. It was called Pinkville in that area. It turned out later that this was in error, and it turned out also the soldiers who were told that everybody who was there would be a Viet Cong supporter were based on a misinformation. So when the soldiers arrived, and this is showing the battle plan, they moved in from various directions with the notion that if there were any civilians in the village, they probably were communists, and therefore if they were put to death, it was helping the cause. It happened that there was a photographer along with the troops who was there mostly to take training pictures. And then when the massacre started, he happened to be on site and took pictures of what was happening. This is probably the most famous picture that he took. This was a picture of terrified women who realized the killing was going on all around. And just a few moments after this picture was taken, all the women in this picture were killed. This is another of the famous pictures of the massacre, where in a ditch beside the village, a whole series of bodies could be seen. After the war was over, the Vietnamese made a memorial park out of this area. The American army had bulldozed the village entirely, so they had to sort of set something up. And this was an early version of a museum with the names of 504 or so people, plus their ages, who were killed in the massacre. Today, there's still sort of marks of how important this was. This is a wall filled with mosaic pictures of kind of a dramatization of what happened with the helicopters coming in and the loss of life. There's a striking statue, a very large statue. You see the foot of it here of the civilians, some of them who already were dying, as a site for the massacre. And since the massacre, there have been annual meetings, memorials of what happened. And it was at these meetings that the Quakers began to become present. These are the funeral flowers, which are presented. They're very dramatic, and they have tags on them telling who's given them the particular memorial flowers. And this is a tag that has the Madison Quaker's name on it. The two key players here, one of them is here in the room, are Mike Bain and Doe Van John. Doe is incredibly dedicated to this project. He was an English teacher, very much concerned about what was happening in Vietnam. And when he and Mike met, the chemistry was extremely good and creative. And much of what happens is really the result of Mike and Doe. Their sizes are a little different. And now I'm going to turn the mic over to Joe, because this is what the park looked like when we were there just a few months ago. They had this elaborate sort of balloon thing over the park. And I want you to notice the building in the center there. That is the new museum. And we're going to say a little bit more about that as we go along. So, Joe?
This was my first... You want to sit down so that... This was my very first trip to Vietnam. Of course, I've watched the project over the years, and I've heard so much about it, and this was the first time I really felt able to go. I was struck with how much we've been in India the last couple of years for a visit, and I was struck with how much South Vietnam and South India had in common in so many ways besides the weather. But this very unique and very sad happening, you'd say, isn't it funny to celebrate such terror? But it does keep in mind what we want to prevent in the future. Joe, if you want to go back just one second to that's the Memorial Arch, and there were literally thousands of people that poured into this celebration. And the building behind, as Joe mentioned, is a museum. And every wall graphically illustrates exactly what happened at the My Lai Massacre. It's pretty overwhelming. There are a couple of people that I think people here know. Our own Gil Halstead, whom you hear over the public radio, and Norm Stockwell, whom you hear over radio. Come on. Wart, of course. How could I forget Wart? They were also taking pictures and doing some reporting back when they got back with Mike and Doe. This is it shows you the difference in height. This is a village door that they have recreated. And Joe and I aren't exactly giants, but we felt pretty giant-like here. The site of the massacre has been celebrated by something that's totally opposite, and that is the Peace Park that Madison Quakers have put together. Here is a group planting trees, and when we returned, I wasn't there for the planting of these trees, but now these are stocky trees, and it just shows the progress that can happen by nature as we enter the park. I was very impressed with the schools that have been built. That is one part of a quadrangle, and the children were not terribly interested in the speeches, but they were very good. And children are children everywhere, and they are absolutely delightful. But here they are, listening, or at least sitting, through the speech that's about to happen. Well, first of all, though, we wanted to dig the foundations for the last part of the triangle. And you'll notice Mike is in costume here.
And Joe and two others were in costume, and perhaps Mike can tell us a little bit more about the significance of those costumes a little later. But here we are digging the foundation for the next school. Is that right?
The what?
The foundation for the next school?
Right. There are two eight-room primary schools.
Two eight-room primary schools have already been funded by the Madison Friends. And if you see those two blue signs on one of them, on the left it says, for a profit in 10 years, invest in trees. The one on the right says, for a profit for 100 years, invest in children. So that's one eight-room primary school. Another one faces it, and now construction has already begun this summer and will for a third eight-room primary school.
Thank you. We listen to a lot of speeches. One of the remarkable things about this gathering is that we had a large delegation from Japan and some survivors from the bombing at Hiroshima. This gentleman who's giving a talk in Vietnamese, in Japanese, that was then translated into Vietnamese, and thank heavens, not translated into English, but given we were given an English copy, was very hard-hitting as he compared the travesties of these two events. I wish all of America could have heard this speech because it was very powerful. These are the survivors. These are survivors of Hiroshima. And they were connecting Agent Orange and the survivors of Agent Orange with survivors of Hiroshima and the devastation of both of those events. The passion of the connection here can only begin to tell us that these two events were significant.
There were two significant things that happened, I think, as a result of this 40th anniversary. One is represented here, the effort to link the damaging effects of the nuclear explosions, atomic explosions in Hiroshima, with the consequent cancer that goes on and on, and the sort of cancer that's produced by Agent Orange in the whole Vietnam War. And what's happening here, although it seems a little bizarre, is that Professor Soweda, who's the one on the right, who is concerned very much about the long-range effects of the bombing in Hiroshima, is hugging the museum director in My Lai, who had agreed to come to the next Hiroshima anniversary in August in Japan and try in a more dramatic way to link the long-range effects of Agent Orange in Vietnam to the long-range effects of the nuclear bombing. So this was one of the things that emerged from this particular meeting. You want to say a little bit about the microloans? Okay. Microloans, these are very touching, a small amount of money given to somebody who will raise a water buffalo or a cow or something like that. And for a very small amount of money, they are able often to improve their life a lot. So for several days, we visited a series of families that had received microloans through this whole process. And this is just one of those gatherings. There's a microloan cow.
In order to get this loan, you have to promise to build a shed for your cattle. Some of these sheds were pretty small, and I felt sorry for the cattle. But this one was better. And the idea is, of course, that the cattle will produce more. And a successful loan like this can support this person for a number of years. So it's not giving away money, but you have to take this money and make it work for you and for the community. And I was so impressed with the quality of the money that was invested in these people. It's all they've got, and they've got to make it work. And so it's worth investing in.
And the repayment rates are quite staggering, almost 100%. The other thing that emerged from this was a unique dentist, Larry, and he is a dentist without borders. He's a self-created dentist who simply goes around the world finding places where people's teeth need to be worked on. And he happened to be in Vietnam when we were there, very much impressed with what was going on. And he said if the Madison Quakers can get a clinic going, he'd be very happy to provide his free services. So here he is. I mean, this looks like it's in a hospital. It's really kind of not. He just put his sort of surgical dressings on and was working on somebody's teeth. So this is kind of one of the next projects we're going to be involved in, is trying to get a clinic in the area, because the medical services are pretty inadequate. And when you get a volunteer like Larry, it's a great deal. And then you always end up a shot in Vietnam with kids. They're absolutely terrific. You want to say something about kids in Vietnam?
And during the war, you might remember that Madison Quakers, actually National AFSC, had a series of pictures of beautiful Vietnamese children. Now, who can not like a beautiful child? And I thought that that was a very effective thing that the AFSC did during the Vietnam War in terms of trying to bring the humanity of the Vietnamese people to America, because we were not getting that picture anywhere else. And, of course, it's true today. You can't resist a set of beautiful kids.
Mike, do you want to say something before we turn the lights on?
I don't know if it's because they're Quakers or just who they are. What Joanne and Joe did not mention is that they supported me financially for 9 years. They paid my rent, my utilities, food, everything I needed to do this work, because I was poor, still am. Without their financial support, none of this would have happened. There isn't much more to say, but that photo of the two of Professor Sawadan and Mr. Combe hugging each other, these are two survivors. Mr. Combe is a survivor of the My Lai massacre. Professor Sawada is a survivor of the atomic bombing at Hiroshima. And Mr. Combe was so moved. Nobody has ever... This is the first time the victims themselves are starting to unite. And that's what will be talked about when Mr. Combe, survivor of the My Lai massacre and director of the My Lai Memorial, will talk about when he comes to Hiroshima this August. This is important. These, in my mind, are the new leaders. I mean, we've seen the dismal failure by our military leaders. Let's develop new leaders and follow them.
Rose, you want to say where we go now? We can turn the lights on.
Oh. Well, now is the time when Prairie members have a chance to ask our speakers questions and discuss anything that they wish. Yes, Mitch.
Would you please, yes, and then can you keep one to answer? And you guys could stay up front, and they would be able to take questions. Yeah.
I was wondering, with 500 people killed, over 500 people killed, who was left to continue this village, and how hard was that to get moving again, to get things together?
Thank you.
Well, these 500 people were not the whole village. I mean, there were probably 10,000 people in the village. They're really widespread.
That's what people don't really understand, this huge museum.
Please take the mic. Please take the mic. Yeah.
Thank you. This museum that I was speaking of, and we had pictures of, makes you understand that this was a much larger village.
Two thoughts. In fact, three thoughts. One is, I was to be in the first wave of the invasion of Japan, and so I wouldn't be here probably, except for the bombs, which I hate as much as I think anybody does. It saved my life, but it still wasn't worth it, I think. The other one, I regret that I didn't join the students on the university campus in protesting the Vietnam War. I was one of those people who just did their job and should have joined the students.
It crossed my mind when you were showing the two men hugging that maybe the next person to join them would be someone who had suffered from depleted uranium. in Iraq or elsewhere.
That would certainly be something natural. In fact, as one watches what's going on, one realizes, in a sense, that the tragedy continues and continues and continues. When one speaks of the weapons of mass destruction and biological weapons, ironically, the only nation that has actually used them systematically has been the United States, dropping the atomic bombs and then using Agent Orange, which was a deadly biological weapon.
And I can't. I'm awfully glad you're here, but actually, it's a very controversial historical fact that we did not need to drop those bombs. The war was over, and that makes what happened triply sad.
There's an excellent resource that deals with this issue called The Decision to Drop the Bomb. The author is Gar Alperowitz, and he did extensive research in military records and governmental records and basically came to the conclusion that Joanne was talking about, was that the bomb did not need to be dropped. The sticking point for Japan's surrender was they wanted to keep their emperor, and Truman was fine with that. But at the same time, this atomic bomb was being researched, and once it was tested successfully, you know, he did a complete 180 and never looked back. It's a must-read book, this Decision to Drop the Bomb, to really understand what was going on behind the scenes.
And if you haven't, is that on? If you haven't seen the nuclear display that's circulating around Madison, it's very much worth seeing. We had it down at the Capitol, and it's been probably even here, no? Mm-hmm. Well, it should come out here. Anyway, Lee Weiss is kind of in charge of it, and it's a nice group. Nice, if you can call devastation nice, but I mean it's a very thorough group of the history of the bomb and what has happened to Japan since, which is bringing it up to date.
I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the microloan program, Mike, especially. I think you shared the microloan program and share more about some of the kinds of things people are using the money for and what you see as the results.
Well, our first microcredit program was started in My Lai. I mean, that was the very first project we all got involved with. And that's how I met Quakers, actually, for the first time. You know, I'd kind of heard about them, but the only thing I really knew about Quakers was that they sold oatmeal.
We told them we also sell oil.
Yeah. So the loan fund in My Lai was begun in January 1994. Since then, we have established loan funds in 16 villages and have provided almost 3,000 loans to poor women through those 16 villages.
Why women?
Well, at the time, we agreed that the proposal for this My Lai loan fund came from the Quang-ai Province Women's Union. And so when we agreed to fund this proposal, we also agreed to work with them as partners. Well, in the intervening years, I have become so impressed with working with women. I wish they were our partners for everything we do. I just get so tired of men's BS. So, but officially, we were required to work with them if we were going to help fund this loan fund. But it's amazing. Well, Muhammad Yunus, who founded the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, which was the inspiration for these loan fund programs, founded that in, I believe, the late 80s. A few years after the founding of this Grameen Bank, they evaluated the program and discovered that loans to women were much more successful than loans to men, and they changed their whole mandate. And that's held true all throughout the different countries.
He found that the men were drinking it up and wasting it in other ways. Women don't do that. They support their families.
You know, present company excluded. Well, in the past, generally along the seacoast, along the coast, the loans go for seafood processing or buying a small boat or fish nets. And it's a more diversified. In the mountains, because the feed is free, you know, grass is plentiful, cows are the goal of women, to buy a cow. And also because of the economic improvement in the cities in Vietnam, there's this rising demand for beef, because now the Vietnamese can finally afford to eat meat. So in the mountains, it's almost exclusively cows or pigs. Along the coast, a little more diversified, but quite a bit focused on seafood.
I got the next question.
Well, yes, that was in My Lai. One of the first recipients was Mrs. Lien, and she and her son dug a shrimp pond by hand, and she used her loan for shrimp. But we have moved away from that because it's very devastating. Shrimp farms are devastating towards the environment, and they're very susceptible to disease, so we don't fund those anymore.
Mike, I was wondering more about the school. You're adding the third one. Are all of the students from the neighboring area and just come for the day, or are some coming from further away and staying either with people in the village or at the school itself?
All the students are from that village. And I should say, you know, we call it My Lai, but the village is not named My Lai. The village back during the war was named Son My, S-O-N-M-Y. And the massacre actually took place. It had four hamlets and six sub-hamlets. And so our military, not bothering with the real name, just called it My Lai 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And so it was a hamlet and a sub-hamlet where this massacre actually happened. The village is now called Tinh Khe. All the students coming to these schools at My Lai are local students from that village. And up to this point, most students can only go for a half a day because there's just not enough classroom space. So there would be no way students from outlying villages would be allowed to come and use that space when there's not enough for local children.
I guess I'm next. And, you know, a lot of us get appeals in the mail for seed money for various organizations. And it's so hard to know when you're sitting here in America just where the money will go when you send it. Obviously, money contributed to you and your work goes to that work. And what I think many of us might be interested in is just how we contribute to this in a way that assures that it will be used that way. You follow me? No? I'm thinking of things like aid to Africa that ends up in the hands of the robber. I'm thinking of things like aid to Africa that ends up with the robber barons or things that are intercepted. We have no way of knowing. And this seems to be a more direct and personal route for getting help.
Once it gets to Vietnam. That's what you're saying?
Once it gets to Vietnam. Okay. What do you do about that?
We bow down and gratefully thank our partner, Mr. Phan Van Do, the man you saw with me in that photo, because he oversees everything. You know, he monitors where the money goes, that it's actually gone to where it's supposed to be, used the way it's supposed to be used. As for me, you know, he and I will randomly check in the loan fund, you know, the villages with the loan funds to make sure that these women were, you know, who use the funds, use them the way they're supposed to be used. But it's mostly we rely completely on Phan Van Do to monitor all of these programs.
Do is truly a remarkable man, and I'd heard so much about Do all these years, and it was just a lot of fun to meet him. But in the course of our visit, he told us about his own history. I believe his own father was killed by the French.
His grandfather was tortured and killed by the French. His mother had delivered him but was still hemorrhaging from the birth, and because of the French planes flying over and bombing their village, she bled to death. 9 years later, the beginning of the American War, his father was suspected of working with the Viet Cong, and one night when he was 9 years old, he remembers this vividly. It's the traumatic event of his life. He loved his father. And this Viet Cong officer came in with two guns strapped to his hips, had his father's arms bound behind his back. The next day, his father was executed. All the villagers were supposed to come out and watch this, and his father was shot in the head. 1 year later, his only brother, elder brother, was shot by the South Vietnamese army. And he says this is a typical Vietnamese story, he said.
So he is highly motivated to prevent war.
Also, on the card, if you do want to give money, there are places you can check what you want. And one of the checks is, I want this to be used for the loan funds. So there's a school, there's a park, and then the loan funds. And you're looking at the infrastructure. There's half of it, and there's the other half of it.
small bureaucracy.
No, this is really a partnership. I mean, because without the elders, you know, nothing would have happened. Without Phan Van Do in Vietnam, what would have happened to our project? Without contributors, we'd be dead in the water.
So. Well, I've heard you say that My Lai is really a bunch of little hamlets. I wonder if you could just lay out a little bit more. So I'm a person who is pretty visual, so I want to know, you know, are there paths between them? How far apart are they? How many people in a little hamlet? You know, that kind of thing.
Actually, maybe I'm fairly good at answering that because I'd never been there before. And as I said, it reminded me a lot of South India. But there are well-paved roads. We're not thinking about little huts anymore. The Vietnamese are coming into the 21st century rapidly. And their economy is growing. They're very hard-working people. I compare sometimes the South Indian shops and roads to the South Vietnamese shops and roads, and the South Vietnamese shops are a little bigger and a little cleaner, and the road curbs are a little better made. I mean, the Vietnamese are very enterprising people, and they're coming up fast.
So I guess what I was getting at that time, did you say there were 10,000 people really in that area?
Well, plus or minus. These villages are so spread out. You know, the massacre only happened in one small area in the village. And, you know, there are paved roads now going, well, I mean, My Lai has internet cafes. I mean, but this is right along Highway 1, and most of the villages along Highway 1 are doing much better than the villages in the mountains. But a village will have just kind of winding paths going from here to there. For example, in the mountains where we have many of our loan fund programs, they're mostly ethnic people. The children, if they can go to school, will have to walk 2 or 3 hours one way over the mountains, you know, to the school, go for as long as they can come, you know, they can, and come back 2 or 3 hours walking, you know, back home. I don't know if that answers your question.
I understand, I think, and I applaud what your focus on a better future, but I'm still riven by the past, and I wonder what insights you have about whether the monster is isolated on some other beast or is inside each one of our own souls. In terms of what happened.
I'm not sure what the question was.
Is what happened with Callie, that's something which is just aberration in human nature, or is that something that's a part of all of us?
Thank you. This is a message I've been trying to... I traveled extensively around the U.S., you know, giving talks to raise money. And, in fact, spent all day yesterday contacting Unitarian congregations out in California. And before I even... First of all, people will come up to me after the presentation, you know, with tears in their eyes and say, we've learned nothing since Vietnam. And I have to tell them, no, we've learned nothing since 1492. Nothing has changed. You know, our actions have not changed since 1492. And what we're doing as a great power is really no different from any great power throughout human history. We're following that same kind of trite path. I have studied, since I'm, you know, began working on My Lai, I've been trying to understand the nature of evil. And with my studies and with talking to combat veterans, I'm not a combat veteran, thank God, I came to realize that years ago that I can't judge these guys who committed the massacre at My Lai, because the only difference between me and them and those who committed the massacres at Nanking or Auschwitz or Rwanda is I wasn't there. We have to face up to the fact that the potential for evil exists in all of us. And it's a hard, dark, scary place to go, but if we're going to change, we have to look inside ourselves first. Because to point our fingers at the guys who committed the massacre at Milai, or Haditha, or Abu Ghraib, is to miss the point.
Mike, I had a couple of details I thought would be good to clarify. I'm sorry. Yeah, I was thinking someone had asked for some more information about the loan program, and I thought it might be interesting for people to know about how much money on the average the loan recipients received and what the repayment rate was. And then I thought it would also be interesting to talk a little bit more about, like, it seems like the point of this is how to make some change occur. And you talked about that photograph of the two gentlemen together and where that could lead to future conversations about war victims and maybe talking about people in Iraq now. What can we do to help encourage more thoughtfulness about getting involved in war and what the repercussions of it will be? I know it is. Sorry.
I might have to have you refresh my memory. Well, as far as the loans, for years and years, the top end for the loans was $100. And it made some amazing, profound changes in some of these women's lives. But again, this economic upturn, well, I mean the steady economic growth, which loan term. So that's changed. But even at that, $300 or $400, not much, and they get quite a tremendous profit from that cow. Now, what were your other
questions? Repayment rates.
Repayment rates for years and years were close to 100%. That changed when we went into the mountains at the request of the Vietnamese government to help the ethnic people. I mean, this is just these loan funds, or just loans, first of all, were outside of their experience. Taking care of cows were outside of their experience. You know, they didn't know that during the monsoons, these cows have to be sheltered, you know, something wrapped around the sides to keep them dry and warm. And so one village, we lost 6 cows. Now, that's out of 30 or 40 women who have, you know, borrowed money, but, you know, still a minority. But we never, it was a shock. We were spoiled. Now, we could withdraw from the mountains and continue to fund villages along the coast and have, on paper, have an excellent repayment rate. But these are the poorest of the poor. And so we have put a hold on funding any more ethnic villages and are working with the existing ethnic villages with the women's unit to train them in the proper way of raising cows.
Mike is being excessively modest about working in the ethnic areas. During the Vietnam War, the ethnic areas were seen by the South Vietnamese as enemy territory. So not only were they minorities who didn't speak Vietnamese, but they were seen as enemy people. So after peace came, the ethnic minorities have been almost consistently a disadvantaged group from the memories of the Vietnam War. And it was quite impressive when 2 years ago the government said we could go into that area. Almost no other NGOs had been allowed into the area because of the sensitivity from the war. And it's been one of the more rapidly growing and tougher areas to work in.
I want to put in my 2 cents. It seems to me that you Unitarians and we Quakers and anybody who wants to speak truth to power has to hold our current electoral people to feet to the fire and say no more war. Simple as that.
Okay. Are these the Hmong?
The question is, are these the Hmongs? And they are of the same sort of background. The Hmongs were in Laos, but these are just similar, and Vietnam. But they're probably several dozen minority groups that speak different languages, and they're typically up in the hills, and they're typically minorities.
I'm going to stand now because it's my turn. It has been for some time. I would like to know a little more about this hospital, the Quaker hospital. What could it do during the war, and what is it doing now?
During the war, the policy of the American Friends Service Committee when a war breaks out is to try to provide assistance to the civilian victims on both sides of the war. So as soon as the Vietnam War broke out, the American Friends Service Committee did set up a hospital. It happened to be in Quang Nai, specializing in amputations and burn victims and the training of prosthetics manufacturers. So when I visited it in 1969, it was an amazing sort of operation with, I remember being in a room once and realizing I was the only person with 4 limbs. everybody else was missing at least one. And they were training the amputees to make the prostheses, especially for kids, because as kids grow, you have to have longer legs and longer arms. That ended when the war ended. Ironically, in this trip we just went to, we did have one of the doctors from that period come to be present, and that was quite touching to have her come back and be in the area. This new thing, and Mike, you want to say a little bit more about the possibility of starting a clinic? This is an idea that's about 2 months old with Larry and the dentist. You want to pick up on that?
This refers to that photo of Willie Manteris, the dentist from Pittsburgh. He spent 3 weeks, 5 or 6 days a week, all day long, pulling teeth, you know, doing fillings, taking care of abscesses, that sort of thing. And he made a profound impression on the people of the village. He had a better relationship with the people in that area in My Lai than I do. I mean, it's pretty intimate, you know, pulling somebody's teeth. And so it was Phan Van Do again, the visionary, who thought we should expand this, build a clinic where not only, you know, people can have their teeth taken care of, but every kind of outpatient service, you know, eyes, ear, nose, throat. And so I've been calling around, and there are teams of health people that do this sort of thing. One team goes to India to take care of refugees from Tibet. And they said, as soon as your clinic's built, we want to go there and help. So it's a natural, you know, there are healthcare people from Cuba that do the same thing. Doctors Without Borders. Everything just kind of fell into place. We've even got a matching grant of $50,000 already, before the paperwork's even finished.
Still may seem strange to love your dentist, but I guess if you haven't had a dentist look at your mouth for 20 years, it's a wonderful experience. There's a question. Yeah.
You mentioned the fact that the people depend a lot on fish for getting proteins. And I know that the Mekong Delta area specifically used to be extremely productive of fish before the enormous ecological damage due to the war mainly. And there are efforts to restore that to something approaching its original productivity. And of course, there's been also enormous ecological damage elsewhere due to spraying of Agent Orange, especially. Can you say a few words about that?
Agent Orange?
Well, actually, the delta and the mangroves in the delta weren't affected that long-term as other areas in Vietnam because of the tides. The tides would come and wash out the toxin out to sea. The crisis in the delta now are these shrimp farms, where the Vietnamese farmers are just cutting down all the mangroves and starting up these shrimp ponds, and that's caused great ecological destruction.
My question is, how have the relationships between the majority population and the minority groups, have they evolved? You said finally people are getting in there. What kind of acceptance do minority people have if they come into the towns and send their children to school and university? Are these paths open to them? Do they feel they're part of one country, or are they enclaves that are struggling to hang on?
Yeah, that's a good question, but it's a complex question. There are 53 ethnic tribes in Vietnam, and they've been treated over the centuries by the Vietnamese people the way Native American people here have been treated by whites. So there's centuries-old hatred by the ethnic people, you know, towards the Vietnamese. You know, the ethnic people, for the most part, looked on them as animals, not human. And so that was easy for our CIA to go in there during the American War in Vietnam to recruit the ethnic people to fight. There are outside forces that still come in, quite often through Cambodia, to foment uprisings by the ethnic people, you know, against the Vietnamese government. So it's really sensitive. And I don't know, I think the Vietnamese government was kind of coerced into providing aid for the ethnic people. I mean, they had a 2-year program where they built tens of thousands of new homes for the ethnic people. They budget millions of dollars every year for programs for the ethnic people. you know, schooling, opening up schooling for the ethnic people, with the emphasis on they are part of Vietnam. They must learn Vietnamese language, that sort of thing. There's still, I'm sure, there's still prejudice. But the government has been kind of either forced or one way or the other, the government has opened up more opportunities for the ethnic people, say, mostly in the last 10 years.
Are young girls also educated in your schools? And I was just wondering about the role of women in society there. Are they encouraged to go into leadership positions?
I'll let Mike answer that more thoroughly, but I observed that the Vietnamese women are watching television, obviously, wearing spiked high heels, are coming right into the Hollywood era.
Well, they're a bit deeper than that. The Women's Union was created in 1930 by the Viet Minh, you know, Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh, to be support for the Viet Minh in their fight against the French. And then, of course, their support for the NVA and Viet Cong in their fight against the Americans. And so there are Women's Union organizations in every village. And then there's the village level, district, province, and then central. And part of the mandate of the Women's Union of Vietnam is to introduce legislation to the national government to better the conditions of women. You know, equal pay for equal work, that sort of thing. I mean, issues that are very common, you know, for women all over the world. Like women all over the world, no matter what is said on paper, they're still not seen as equal to men. But that, you know, that's all changing. You know, and especially being exposed to Western ideas and Western culture.
And we visited some of the women's unions, and these women were very efficient. And they were quick to describe their projects, and I'd say that I guess to oversimplify, they were very much on the ball.
Well, what about the little girls in school? Are the little girls going to school?
Yes, they are.
At the same rate as the little boys?
I can't really delve too deeply in those, you know, because if anything I'm doing or asking seems critical of the Vietnamese government, then I'm in trouble. Madison Quakers are in trouble. So I hear things here and there. I don't even know what the curriculum is for, you know, elementary school kids. You know, there's a lot taught about Ho Chi Minh, you know, the communism and that sort of thing, but I don't know how much of, what percentage of their time is taken up with that stuff. And whether girls are treated equally to boys in the classroom, I have no idea.
Oh,
I have no idea. When I walk into a classroom, well, Lois, remember those photos? Marquette Elementary School did an art exchange with the children of My Lai last year, and I took a bunch of photos as they're looking at. And I mean, my memory is there's at least as many girls as boys in that classroom.
Okay. We have time for two more questions. Go.
Have any of the American soldiers involved in the massacre written personal accounts of the experience?
They've not written personal accounts, but they were contacted. There is one single resource that I recommend to anybody who wants to learn about the massacre at My Lai, but massacres in general. How is it possible that our boys, most of them raised Christian, knowing good from evil, can do something like that? And that's called 4 Hours in My Lai by Michael Bilton and Kevin Sim. None of the perpetrators of the massacre have written anything, but they were interviewed by Bilton and Sim, and so their thoughts and feelings come through in this book and film. But this year, for the 40-year anniversary, one of the guys who took part in the massacre was there at My Lai. I mean, I hadn't heard he was coming, but the media kind of focused on his being there. And I don't know, it's all in Vietnamese, so I don't know actually what he said, but Mr. Com, director of the My Lai Memorial, shook his hand, and he said later, this was for humanitarian reasons. I can never forgive him and the others.
One of the representatives of the World Press that was there was a woman from BBC, and she had listened to hundreds of hours of tape recordings that are in the archives in Washington of people describing what they were doing on that day. So it's available, but in huge quantities, and is accessible to the public if they're interested in it. So that's sort of the individual stories, not in writing, but on tape-recorded voices.
I was just going to say that I've been involved in this art exchange program with Mike, and so I brought along today a lot of the drawings that the children did in Vietnam. If people would like to see them afterwards, I'd be glad to bring them out.
Okay, great. It's fascinating to watch kids respond to each other's kids. One of the pictures that is totally puzzling in Vietnam is called ice fishing. How do you sit on water and wait for fish to bite?
So please join me in thanking our guests. Time for our offertory. Prairie runs on love and volunteerism and also needs your financial support. We're going to be passing baskets, and we would ask that you pass the baskets to the ushers in the aisles rather than the person behind you. And Eileen will be playing Finlandia. Thank you. Now we have the opportunity for guests and visitors to introduce themselves, and we hope you will feel comfortable enough to tell us your name and what brought you here today. And I would ask you two to wait for the microphone.
Hi, my name is Diana Levesey. I'm a Unitarian Universalist, and I go to Beloit College. I'm living in Madison over the summer, and I'm originally from Roanoke, Virginia.
I just wanted to say that today is the first day that I brought my young daughter, Sydney. She's starting to only take one nap, so we're trying it out. This morning, she was one crying earlier, so we'll see how that went. But hopefully y'all can meet her and welcome her like you've welcomed my son and me. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Lois Bergerson, and I'm an old friend of Ruth Calden's, and have been working with Mike on the MeLive project, both doing some of the newsletters and involved with the art exchange program at Marquette School.
My name is Jennifer Benner. I'm just looking for a community, I guess.
Thank you.
I want to welcome some old Prairie members who have returned for this service. Molly Plunkett and Peter Anderson. Give them a hand.
Thank you.
I would call your attention to the announcements in your order of service. First on the inside page and then the calendar on the back. And ask if there are any additional announcements that didn't make it into the order of service.
I just wanted to mention again that cards to support this project will be for sale in the lobby after the program.
This Social Action Committee of Prairie has a number of videotapes and books downstairs to lend to members, and one of them is The Sound of the Violin in Me Lai, featuring Mike Bean. So if you want to borrow it, it's available.
This coming Saturday is a men's shelter breakfast. We need a couple of people who want to be up bright and early, 4:30 in the morning. And our happy announcement is, as of yesterday, we are officially linked with James Reeb, and they're going to be sharing, so every other month they will be collecting the money, and I'm not quite sure how the buying the food's going to work yet, and we're trying to get someone from them, from their group, to be with us this Saturday. So we're going to hopefully have members of Reeb and Prairie serving breakfast together, but every other month the other will take responsibility for collecting. So because we're not going to have to collect next month, everybody can dig in a little deeper. We have run a little short. We've stopped using, we've had to change some of the food we're buying because the food costs have gone up tremendously. So here it is. We serve pretty much a vegetarian meal to these folks now.
Very quick. I don't know if you heard the prelude music we were playing at the beginning, but this was Vietnamese music, which was provided by Reverend Ralph Tuzinski. He has a wonderful CD. It's a lot of wonderful music on it. And I thought maybe kind of nice to put it back on and let it play a little bit after the program.
The annual Summer Spree event will be July 25th, 6th, and 7th at Rick Recking's farm. We have information on the RE portion of the website about the event. This is for students who are in 6th grade and above. We are in need of one more volunteer, so if somebody is interested in hanging out on the farm and hanging out with the kids, eating some food, let me know. And I also just wanted to say thank you for all those who attended Indy's first birthday party last week. It really meant a lot to us. Thank you.
I just realized that I don't think anybody mentioned the death of Fran Romica's husband, Mike, because I think that happened since last Sunday. They were very inconspicuous about it, but there was a gathering yesterday out at Gunderson's funeral home in Middleton, and a number of Prairie people were there. Fran is probably literally our oldest living member, being about 94 this year, and still trucking. She's an amazing lady. Her daughter, Deanne, was there with her. It was just a very pleasant gathering, pictures and so forth, and I was glad a number of us were able to make it, and they were very glad a number of us were able to make it. Fran still gets herself to Elders from Verona.
94.
Sounds like there's some dispute about the age, but it's between 92 and 94. I have one last announcement. For those of you who forgot, we have a potluck after service today, and then we're going to be having our third congregational review session focused primarily on looking at our facilities, needs, and looking towards the future, setting some benchmarks of how we will actually know when we're ready and need to move into a bigger space. So we invite all of you to come, whether you brought food or not, there'll be food available. And it's time for our final hymn. We Shall Overcome, which is page 24 in the songbook, and we'll be singing three verses. Our closing words today will be a responsive reading. Rose?
These are in your program, and please respond with the indented parts. If there is to be peace in the world, there must be peace in the nations. If there is to be peace in the nations, there must be peace in the cities. If there is to be peace in the cities,
there must be peace in the neighborhoods.
If there is to be peace in the neighborhoods,
there must be peace in the hearts.
From Lao Tse. Thank you.
Please greet your neighbor and join us for refreshments and then potluck, and go in peace. Thank you.